Tonight, we have Gary McDarby, who's a principal research scientist at Media Lab Europe, just down the road. It's a great pleasure to have Gary. I first saw Gary on a TV program. There's a documentary made, an RT documentary. And then I went up to one of the open days and had a chance to look around their fantastic setup they have with researchers from all over the world working away in a very sort of creative and open environment. And I love that. So, without any more from me, ladies and gentlemen, Gary McDarby.
Thanks very much, Davey. Obviously, I'm not as big a pull as your last speaker, but hopefully in the next hour or so, I'll try to make it as enjoyable and as interesting and as different as I possibly can. Just a bit of interaction, first of all. How many people in the audience would be very familiar with technology? You just put up your hands there just so I get a sense. Pretty much everyone, all right. Maybe I'm in the wrong place then in that case. I was hoping I'd be able to blow you away with lots of technical jargon, I don't know. And out of it, that's good, because at the end of the day, from whatever perspective we're coming from, technology is shaping our world. It's pretty much, if you think of in history, the big things that have totally and utterly transformed society, it basically ends up being technology, the printing press, the industrial revolution, all these kind of things. And certainly in today's day and age, technology is shaping the world in even a more rapid, won't say progressive, but certainly influential way than any other time in history. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back a little bit and start off with a video clip. And forgive me for the media experts if you're out there, I had to re-edit this, I'm probably breaking every copyright rule going. But I want to just quickly go back to Kubrick's 2001 novel written by Arthur C. Clarke. And there's an opening scene which we'll look at, it takes about 3 or 4 minutes, set to a very famous piece of music, hopefully it'll all come true. And just want you to have a quick look at this, and then we'll talk about it. The same kind of a storyteller that Arthur C. Clarke was, but Kubrick interpreted that part of the 2001 story as a seminal moment in the evolution of the human species. The actual version of the movie, a sentinel appears as sort of a discrete event, and then the primate is looking around and sees suddenly that he can use the bone as a way of shaping the universe around him, or as a way of controlling the universe around him. And in many ways, this is what has differentiated us from much of the rest of life in the universe, possibly. In that we use tools as a way of controlling and shaping and manipulating the universe around us. But if you think of like some dolphins and equally evolved beings, they allow the universe to shape and control and manipulate them. And they adapt accordingly. And there's a beautiful metaphor about how we've diverged from, say, the dolphins. You can imagine the boat crossing the Atlantic, and there's all this brilliant engineering fighting against this incredible storm. And the captain's there heaving at the helm, trying to keep the boat on course. And then you go to the prow of the boat, and there's this pod of dolphins, or school of dolphins, I should say, playing in the currents. Kubrick chose to use Richard Strauss's, probably one of his most famous pieces of music. I don't know whether anyone's familiar with classical music, but there was an era in classical music where they were taking great philosophical constructs and putting them to music. That particular piece of music is Also Sprach Zarathustra, which is probably the most famous novel that Nietzsche wrote. And Richard Strauss was a great proponent of the philosophy of Nietzsche. In Also Sprach Zarathustra, Nietzsche, here's a little extract from it. These masters of today surpass them, O my brethren, these petty people. They are the Superman's greatest danger. This was the fundamental idea in Also Sprach Zarathustra that Nietzsche introduced, the concept of the Superman. Surpass ye higher men, the petty virtues, the petty policy, the sand-grained considerateness, The anthill trumpetry, pitiable comfortableness, the happiness of the greatest number. And rather than despair, than submit yourselves, and verily I love you, because you know not today how to live, ye hire men, for thus do you live best. The basic idea of the Superman is that we should strive to be everything we possibly can be. It's a very individualistic approach. It's very much about the Superman, not the super race. Although with loads of supermen available, you have a super race. And it was actually this philosophy, as I pointed later on, that was misinterpreted by the Nazi regime. So, Nietzsche is most famous for introducing the death of God and the will to power. Or, in other words, the will to dominate, the will to control, the will to manipulate. And in the same way, the primate in that movie chose to manipulate the universe, the species and the environment around him. And this is basically what Kubrick was saying. So that's exactly what it was, the Superman philosophy of the will to control and dominate. Now here's another extract. Such a heroic man of merit has the courage to live dangerously and thus rise above the masses, developing his natural capacity for the creative use of passion. In other words, anything goes. You can rise above the average and do the exception. Now that all sounds fine. I mean, that's, you know, we need great leaders, we need great prophets, we need all this great stuff. But if you misinterpret it, I think you'd go very wrong. And this is what the Nazis, they basically, the Wagners, the Strauss, and so on, the philosophy of Nietzsche was blatantly misrepresenting. But there's a danger in adopting the Superman philosophy, and if you look at Goethe's Faust, for example, it's this idea that humans must learn to live without their gods or any other metaphysical consolations. In other words, they incorporate their devil and evolve beyond good and evil. And what that essentially means is that it's a valueless society. There is no good and evil. It's only you strive to do what you think is right and best and so on. And that's essentially the philosophy of Superman. Now, in my opinion, right, in my opinion, that has served us very well, right? What Nietzsche has done is not that he's saying that this is the way we should be. To be fair to him, in his latter life, if you read the English extract there, what he was saying was he was exposing an instinct of ours, exposing a way of living, a way that says that we do these things unconsciously. And all he did was he made it conscious. And it has served us well. We've got to a point in evolution where we can now reflect and think and develop and do all these amazing things with technology and so on, as I'll point out some of these things later on. But the question, what's missing from that point is, now that we know that we do that, do we carry on going like that? Do we carry on behaving like that, or do we choose a different path? And to be fair to him, you know, if you look at a much more moderate view of Nietzsche later on in his life, he was saying high and noble goals. He's beginning to introduce this idea of what is a noble goal, and perish in pursuit of them. I know of no better life purpose than to perish in attempting the great and the impossible. So why is that important? If you think of an economy, for example, that purely looks at material wealth as a measure of success, which is something that I believe the Irish economy is adopting unquestioningly at the moment, it's nothing more than the philosophy of the Superman. It's basically saying that people aren't important. It's a valueless society. There's this ulterior motive to be the best, the most, to have the biggest, or to be the biggest, to have the most control, be able to manipulate whatever we want. And as I say, I think we're embracing this philosophy wholeheartedly, without question. And as I say, if you think of the boom times in the Celtic Tiger, 1991 to 2001, where our gross national product went from 30 billion to 120 billion in 10 years, homelessness, the poorest of the poor, increased. Now, why are we surprised by that? Because that's the way it's always been. When you have a purely profits-based approach to economics, all that happens is the rich get richer, the divide between those that have and have not widens. And I know I've got some eminent scientists in the room here, I believe that in science we also adopt this philosophy, possibly not as blatantly, but what I think we do is we do things because we can. We don't ask the question why. I mean, at the end of the day, technologists, scientists, all these different people that have an understanding of what's going on in the universe could sit down and decide, what kind of future, what kind of planet do we want to have?
and they could go and build that. There's nothing to stop them doing it, but we don't do it. We do it because we can, and we don't ask the question why.
One of my most favourite people is a guy called Thomas Edison, who was the inventor of the phonograph. And this was done in, I always get the dates of these wrong, the late 1800s, 1880 I think it was invented. And when he was after the invention, he was asked, what will it be used for? And he said, I think it'll be, one great application for it would be, on the top of the, for the moment, he said, one great application would be, I think it would put people to sleep at night when there's nobody there to help them do that. So that was his vision of the phonograph. And if you think of the music industry, which he didn't predict, or billions of other applications of recording music, or recording sound, that was missed. Now, that's wonderful. I mean, ideas come from everywhere, and Edison was one of the most greatest inventors of all time. But I wonder, would it be possible for the likes of an Edison today, and a load of other Edisons today, to sit down and say, how would we like to invent the future? What would we like to invent to really make this a more sustainable place to live in, a more community-orientated place, a more people-centric place? What would we invent to do that? And that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that that's the way we should be. That's the prophets, as in PROPHETS, philosophy that I think we should adopt. So that's the background. And you've seen that, some philosophical background. That's in many ways, the thinking behind taking the approach I'm going to show you today in terms of how we can use technology from a people-centric approach. And I'm going to simply introduce a couple of ideas that have come out of our group, the Media Lab Europe. I'll explain a little bit what Media Lab Europe does for those of you that don't know. And I'll talk a little bit about the group, the Mind Games group, some of the projects. And then I'll talk about partnerships to realisation, because it can't be done without lots of people. It's no point being an individual in this game anymore. You can get up and you can talk about these things, but if it's not partnerships, corporates and academics and social outreach organisations working together, this stuff won't go anywhere. It'll just be nice to listen to, and it won't actually affect any kind of change. And then I'll talk about a specific project called the Clubhouse, which is an initiative we have on the campus in Media Lab and the Liberties, which is an interesting idea about how you might use technology differently, and then draw a few conclusions.